With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Welcome to episode 61 of The Hi-Lo, the weekly news and pop culture podcast brought to you by journalists Pandora Sykes and Dolly Alderton. Welcome. Bienvenido.
I hope you've been enjoying the heatwave. Have you been enjoying the heatwave, Pandora?
I've only just got back to the heatwave, but I have been enjoying the heatwave, yeah.
I'm up and down with it, to be honest.
A roundup of this week's controversies. Melania Trump's I Really Don't Care, Do You? Jacket from Zara. We need to talk about Kevin author Lana Shriver's defence of her anti-diversity rant. And Johnny Depp's Rolling Stone interview, which revealed that he once tried to pull out his own tooth while at dinner with Penelope Cruz.
We've all been there. I couldn't believe Melania wore that jacket. I was so, so shocked. And I do not buy that nonsense about it's just accidental and it's just clothes.
There's only two possibilities, right, with Melania and that jacket, and they're both inadequate. The first scenario is that she didn't realise the impact of her jacket, and the FLOTUS's comms director, Stephanie Grisham, said, "It's just a jacket, there's no hidden message. I hope the media isn't going to choose to focus on her wardrobe," which some have said is actually a ruse in itself, as it allows the White House to then claim that the media is making fake news about her clothes, and therefore
that's
distract from the shitty immigration policy that's obviously been getting so much criticism. Trump actually contradicts Melania's miso-ignorant shtick entirely. He said that her jacket was a response to fake news, in that they're saying that they don't care about it anymore. The second option, of course, as you mentioned, is that Melania did know and that she was trying to make a point. And to use immigrant children to make that point is vile. But then the whole administration uses immigrant children. They put out the message of, if you come to the border, you will be separated from your children. One lovely thing out of this is that a brand called Wild Fang copied the Zara jacket and sold out, with all sales being pledged to a refugee and immigrant support service in Texas.
I think that that fake news theory and that kind of watch the birdie distraction technique for something which is nonsense, actually, relatively speaking, I think that's a pretty dark theory, but I think it's pretty accurate.
It's been reported that when Melania was told the average length of stay in the Immigrants Children's Centre in Texas that she was visiting for kids aged between 12 and 17 was 42 to 45 days, she goes, "That's great." When asked for advice, she told children to be kind and nice to each other, and to another bunch of detainees, she simply said, "Good luck."
I think they're both just completely fucking useless. It's like they both need compassion and empathy training, and I wish they would just study it and copy it. I don't even mind if they don't feel it at this point.
The thing is, you have to remember that, like, a lot of world leaders aren't charismatic. It's why we love Barack Obama. But, you know, Hillary Clinton's not charismatic. Theresa May's
not
charismatic.
It's not about charisma. It's just about feigning, like, basic compassion.
Well, there's an interesting debate, because I think charisma and empathy are very, very linked, because I think they're all about warmth and sort of making people feel that you're relating to them, and a lot of it is projection. And do you remember we were talking about it, I feel, some episodes ago, about how Michelle Obama, her kind of stage behaviour is very inclusive. She's very clever in the way she sort of performs when on stage and talking to a large audience, whereas Hillary Clinton's is very exclusive, and that's where their campaign went wrong. The idea is that there was no use of kind of the we. Anyway, I think kind of political emotional intelligence is really interesting and something to probably talk about another time. I have to say, I'm really disappointed by Lana Shriver. To recap, she wrote in a widely criticised piece for The Spectator a few weeks ago, the beginning of June, in reference to Penguin Random House's new diversity policy. If an agent submits a manuscript from a gay, transgender Caribbean who dropped out of school age 7 and powers around town on a mobility scooter, it will be published, whether or not said manuscript is an incoherent, tedious, meandering, and insensible pile of mixed paper recycling. A few days ago, she defended that piece again for The Spectator. We live in a dour and censorious age, she wrote. Perhaps in future it will prove necessary to write every column twice, the original with wit, playfulness and brio. Then I'll draft a pedantic, leadenly prosaic rendition without any jokes. The thing is, it didn't read like a joke. This isn't about her using her art to push boundaries. She's writing a first-person column as herself about diversity. Mm. And she's being really Germaine Greer meets sort of Jacob Rees-Mogg about this.
In that second column that she's written defending her initial remarks, she says the thing that she has a problem with, specifically about the Penguin diversity proposal, is that it aims to reflect the UK population by 2025. And I think that's just common sense. I think to have an issue with art stories and documentation of experience being expressed as a proportional representation of the population, it's just completely insane. I don't know how you can have an issue with it as a proposal. That must just be her privilege talking, I think. I just think it's disappointing. I don't understand how you can find a problem in that. It's just common sense.
Well, lots of authors like Hanif Qureshi have come out to say, yes, it's skewed, and rightly so, because it's been skewed towards essentially people like you for hundreds and thousands of years. I mean, that's not
technically correct. But if you think that's on pure merit, then you're on another fucking planet.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's the problem, I think, with these people that are, like, blinded by their own privilege, is that they can't accept what their privilege might have afforded
them. Yeah, there's 95% of the bestseller list are white, because whites are better writers, aren't they? I mean, that's, you know, that's the
logic
subject
that makes sense for them, yeah.
On to Johnny Depp. One of the most ridiculous revelations in this interview with Rolling Stone with Johnny Depp, and I haven't read it in full as it's not an easy magazine to get hold of, but God bless the internet for providing me with ample highlights, none of which seemed to confront the fact, however, that he's operating in the world with total ease still, despite never denying beating his ex-wife, something which bothers me every time I see a Dior Homme advert or read about his new super band. Anyway, Johnny Depp...
Super band?
He's in a super band.
What would you mean, super band? It was like Louis Walsh.
It was in the Times about 3 weeks ago. Yeah, he's in an American rock supergroup with Alice Cooper and someone else.
That's so like post-Judges Houses.
Trying to make some money back. Anyway, that's a whole different story. This Rolling Stone interview, one of my favourite things, is that he confirms the rumours that he does wear an earpiece on set so that someone can feed him lines. And he says it's because it allows him to act with his eyes.
Oh, the Tyra Banks School of Acting.
That's amazing. Dolly, you'd love the highlights from it. It also reveals that he bought a sofa from the Kardashians for $7,000 for his daughter. Anyway, my favourite discovery of this week is Big Dick Energy. Do you know about this?
No.
You're going to love this. BDE all started when pop star Ariana Grande revealed, for reasons best known to herself, in a now deleted tweet that her fiancé has a massive schlong.
Good for her.
And a few days later, a user on Twitter named Teen wrote a tweet saying that Pete Davidson, her fiancé, carried himself with big dick energy.
I have to say, the name Pete Davidson doesn't initially shout big dick energy to me.
Well, the internet has gone wild for this, and everyone from BuzzFeed to New York Magazine has written a piece on it. The cut defined BDE as a certain gait, like you have a massive dick swinging around, but it's also a twinkle in the eye, like if you look right at that twinkle, you can see a dick swinging in the eye. Oh God, this is a time to be alive, and I'm not even being ironic. My favourite contribution to the big dick energy conversation was a tweet from a woman called Emily Reynolds, who says that BDE is actually gender neutral. She tweeted, I feel like people are mixing up big dick energy and has a big dick, when actually you do not need to have a big dick to have big dick energy. Mm. I have big dick energy. Lindsay Lohan has big dick energy. Rihanna, big dick energy. Dolly, do you have BDE?
No, not at all. I think I have small dick energy. Small dick and a lot to prove.
I wrote yesterday that I sort of oscillate when it comes to BDE. Some days I'm kind of like ultimo schlong, and other days I'm a bit chody on the confidence.
I don't. I think you're pretty super schlong, I'd say.
CJ, do you have big dick energy?
That's a no comment from CJ.
What have you been enjoying this week, Dolly?
I've got two recommendations this week, and I want to push them very hard and with utmost urgency and distill how completely perfect they both are. So last weekend, I went to my goddaughter Sienna's first birthday. Happy birthday, Sienna. And had a completely blissful time, not least because her other godmother, my friend Jess's husband, he calls himself a godfather-in-law, which we're still debating whether that's an actual thing, recommended a piece of writing that I think might be the best essay I've ever read. It was written by David Foster Wallace in the 90s.
And saw this it's on your
Oh
Insta.
My God. You would love it, Pandora. It was written by David Foster Wallace in the 90s, and it's an account of a 7-day luxury cruise that he went on. And it's about, it probably takes about half an hour to read. But it actually becomes so much more than an account of a luxury cruise and a kind of comic fish out of water sketch. It actually becomes a meditation on aging, consumerism, how we distract ourselves from the kind of prospect of death, the oppressiveness of luxury. It talks about America and Americans and tourism. I'd just like to read the opening couple of paragraphs. It has a really brilliant opening in which he reveals everything he's experienced and learnt from being on this cruise. I have now seen sucrose beaches and water a very bright blue. I have seen an all-red leisure suit with flared lapels. I have smelled suntan lotion spread over 2,100 pounds of hot flesh. I have been addressed as Mon in three different nations. I have seen 500 upscale Americans dance the electric slide. I've seen sunsets that looked computer enhanced. I have, very briefly, joined a conga line. I've seen a lot of really big white ships. I've seen schools of little fish with fins that glow. I've seen and smelled all 145 cats inside the Ernest Hemingway residence of Key West, Florida. I now know the difference between straight bingo and prize-o. I've seen fluorescent luggage and fluorescent sunglasses and fluorescent pince-nez and over 20 different makes of a rubber thong. I've heard steel drums and eaten conch fritters and watched a woman in silver lamé projectile vomit inside a glass elevator. I've pointed rhythmically at the ceiling to the 2-4 beat of the same disco music I hated pointing at the ceiling to in 1977.
Oh, that's brilliant. I look forward to reading that.
I'll link it in the show notes and I'll send you the PDF. It was run in Harper's magazine years and years ago and the original PDF is available online. But it really reminded me of how vital it is for writers to read really good writing. I actually think it's the most important thing a writer can do write. I read it on the train home, came back to my desk and wrote a column in about 45 minutes, which is unheard of for me, that I was really, really pleased with. And I'm never pleased with my writing. And I really think it's because I was so inspired by this piece.
But also, it's doing homework. Now in the digital age of hot takes, when it's like, you know, I'm suspicious of writers who don't read.
But I can be guilty of it. And actually, this was a commitment. It's a massive, massive piece. But I really think I felt my brain change as I was reading it. And hot off the back of reading it,
shot out of you.
This thing shot out of me. And I think...
You should go to the doctor about that.
So yes, I also, afterwards, I was so impressed by his writing, which I'm very ashamed to say I'm just not familiar with at all. So before I get onto the marathon that is Infinite Jest, I ordered his essay collections that are called A Supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again, which is, that's where the cruise essay.
They remind me of a bit of David Sedaris and his essay.
I think it's in that tradition. And the other one that I've ordered is Consider the Lobster, which apparently is another great collection of essays. I've also listened to the whole series of Dear Joan and Jerrica, which I have been yammering on about to anyone who will listen, and I'm about to go do my second listen of it. It's a scripted comedy podcast series about two fictional agony aunts called Joan and Jerrica, created and performed by Julia Davis and Vicky Pepperdine. The description reads, every woman, Joan Damery and Jerrica Demain, have between them worked in the fields of life coaching, female sexual health, psychogenital counselling and sports journalism for the past 32 years. Joan has been married several times and has 5 children, while Jerrica has been married for 30 years and has an only daughter, Cardinal. Joan recently turned her hand to erotic romantic adult fiction, whilst Jerrica has written 5 books on depression. And as you listen to the series, you find that Jerrica has never suffered from depression. It's so beautifully, naturalistically performed. I think it must be part improvised. It's incredibly dark, that in a way that's very characteristically Julia Davis. Both the agony aunts have these really funny recurring tropes. They use this kind of semi-medical language that makes absolutely no sense. And they imperiously hand out completely absurd health advice. They're indiscreet, they're politically incorrect, incredibly self-centered whenever you get a small glimpse into their personal life. They make enormous assumptions about people's lives. They're always on the side of the man, which is really, really funny. And they always blame the woman for whining too much. I have a theory that parts of the characters are a pastiche on Women's Hour. I would love to hear your thoughts. It's an absolute masterpiece, in my opinion. By far the funniest audio series I've ever heard. I cannot recommend it highly enough. I'm sure it will be picked up for a second series, if not maybe TV. And it really had me in proper hysterics laughing. I'm going to insert a clip now. And just as a warning, this is one of the cleanest segments I could find in what is a pretty filthy comedy.
Dear Joan and Jerrica, my husband recently asked if we could have intercourse using his big toes alternately. I didn't really enjoy it. Is there something wrong with me? Pat Jones from Kent.
Right, Pat.
What say you?
What say I? Well, I say good on him. I say good for him. Good for him for spicing it up in the bedroom. And I'm sorry to hear that Pat... what's her name?
Pat Jones from Kent.
Pat Jones from Kent is a little bit more broad-minded. Goodness me, Pat. I mean, you know, here's a lovely guy. And by the look of him, he's strapping and wonderful. He looks broad-shouldered. Mm. He looks like the sort of guy that you'd want to grab onto and
get. He's got that lovely salt and pepper look.
He's got a gorgeous salt and peppery look all over his body.
In less dirty news, I really enjoyed a piece by Laura Freeman, a journalist who we had on the show before to talk about her book, The Reading Cure. She was writing about why meditation is not the answer to millennial angst for the times. Speaking of, and this is awesome, for any student listeners of the podcast, you can subscribe to The Times for 90% off, so it's £26 per year instead of per month. You can find out more at thetimes.co.uk/subscribe, but we recommend a lot of journalism with The Times and The Sunday Times. So if you're a student, know that if that paywall is too much for you, 90% off is brilliant.
Yeah.
Back to the piece. Laura writes that we live in a mindful age when meditation is promised as the cure to our insta ills. But Laura says, why not practice mindfulness? I say, stuff your brain to the brim, she writes. Fill every nook and cranny with arts and books and music. The problem is not that we are exhausted by a rushing world. Many of us are understimulated by days spent poring over emails and Excel, and then overstimulated by nights full of twittering screens. What we lack isn't silence, it's sustenance. Something for starved imaginations to feast on.
I could not agree with that more.
God, she writes like a dream. I ripped it out of the paper because I am old school. So I'll give it to you to have a little read. It's not a long piece.
But also, I've been thinking that for a really long time, but I have nowhere near enough, like, nous or mastery of words to be able to articulate it as beautifully as that. But actually, I think the problem is because I try meditation so much.
I've had headspace on my phone for over a year.
And actually, the thing that soothes and calms me, as she said, is immersing myself in the lives and thoughts and worlds of other people and the stories of other people, instead of fucking navel gazing at the end of my bed in silence.
No one wants to nasal gaze. Just been staring up a snouter all day. I've said to you before, you know, I feel my healthiest mentally when I've had my phone on airplane all day, which is my favourite, reading a good book. People always say,
or just taking in the world,
you know, where do you find the time to read? Like, I have to read. Like, some people have to go to the gym. Arguably, that's also good. But it's a really lovely piece, and the sentiment is bang on. And I think it's really important to have a kind of diversity of opinion on these, like, on these cultural epidemics,
yes,
and epiphanies.
Yes, agreed.
Another piece I thoroughly enjoyed, another one I think will really resonate with you, Dolly, because it's a lot we've talked about before, was Victoria Moss for The Telegraph. Fun fact, I used to assist Vicky at the now defunct InStyle. So Vicky was writing in response to the study from the sociology department at the University of East Anglia, which claims that plus size fashion encourages people to ignore their weight issues. Vicky wrote, I'm not sure anyone has walked into KFC and ordered themselves a family-sized bucket, spurred on by the fact that they can still get a lime green waterfall cardigan and M&S even if they reach a size 32. It looks at the moral issues with the word, you horrible fat bitch. The emotional, when I hear that word, I still flinch, she writes. Being fat is, to quote, entrenched in our social constructs. If you're poor, if you're northern, you're more likely to be fat. It's a great piece, very timely read. My podcast discovery this week is The Economist Radio. It was recommended to me by a high-low listener named Celia, who has a beautiful kidswear brand called La Coqueta. And in particular, she flagged an episode on free speech with the comedian Corinne Fisher, one half of Guys We Fucked, You'd love it, Dolly. Mm. She had a lot of interesting stuff to say about the role of comedy and of free speech. I also really enjoyed the episode with James Comey, who is the sacked director of the FBI. He talks about what scares him about Trump is not the policies themselves, but the decline in American values that he is encouraging. Anne McElvoy is one hell of an interviewer.
I love Corinne Fisher, as you know, and I love her insights on the importance of comedy and truth, so I'll definitely be listening to that.
You'd really like this. I think, you know, if you think of a podcast by The Economist, one might think that that could be a bit alienating, but actually it's really smart and thoughtful, and which is spoiled yet again with, you know, another brilliant publication producing really high quality podcasts. On the book front, I'm reading The Pisces by the poet and essayist Melissa Broder. Melissa is the author of Twitter account and book So Sad Today, and she's written several volumes of poetry. The Pisces is such a cynical, incisive, satirical look at modern America and modern love and the cultural epidemic of anxiety. The main character, Lucy, has a breakdown after breaking up with her long-term boyfriend. She takes 9 Ambien and is found in her car with donuts scattered all around her. She takes a sabbatical in LA dog-sitting for her sister, where she falls in love with a merman. It's not as strange as it sounds. Lucy attends group therapy, and the way Broder writes about it is just brilliant. It shows how valid liberal movements and phrases and concerns can be so easily commodified into a sort of millennial malaise and narcissism. I mean, Joan and Jerrica would go to town on this. I'm just going to read, I think, a particularly brilliant part. This is when she's in group therapy. "So you'd really be okay to never fall in love again for the rest of your life?" I asked her. Brianne looked at me through her clown paint. "I'm feeling judged," said Brianne. "Sorry," I said. "What about you, Lucy? You don't believe that a person can be alone and be content with that?" asked Dr. Jude. "I don't know, probably not. Do you?" "Oh, definitely," said Dr. Jude, yellow teeth flashing. "I don't believe we need another person to complete us. Not even to fuck. Let's be conscious of any triggering language," she said. "Yes, I'm feeling triggered," said Sarah. "Right. Sorry," I said. The room got quiet. "Are you in a relationship, Dr. Jude?" I asked. She paused and toyed with an angel card on the table next to her. It said, "Awakening."
I'd love that.
You'd absolutely love it. Lastly, I was riveted by a piece on AI Insta accounts in Marie Claire, US. Foreign magazines bought in European countries for 10 euros a pop are my guilty pleasure. You may remember recently, I think we were doing the live podcast for Moet, when discussing the it girl that never was, Anna Delvey, I talked about how much the AI influencer, a 19-year-old Brazilian model singer named Lil Michaela, who's worked with brands like Fendi and Prada, freaked me out. And this piece explained who she was and where she came from, and it also introduced another AI Instagram influencer, a black model called Shudu, which was actually created by a white graphic designer, so there was a lot of kind of cultural implications of that. Recently, all of Lil Michaela's posts were deleted by a pro-Trump blonde avatar named Bermuda, who demanded that Lil Michaela reveal her true identity. It turns out this was all a ruse by a CGI company named Brood, who owned both Lil Michaela and Bermuda. But even though we know Lil Michaela to be an avatar, brands are still queuing up to do brand collaborations with her. And in this piece, it suggests that that is because Instagram influencers, IRL Instagram influencers, are no longer relatable. And this piece basically posits that fake influencers may be more relatable to us as consumers than corporal ones because they've sold out. But isn't that worrying? It's a great piece for anyone travelling and any of our US-based listeners.
Do you know, I actually did my first Radio 4 panel show this weekend, and the guy who was sitting next to me is really interesting. He's like the leading expert, Museum of Curiosity.
I'll check that out.
And he's like it's not out to the autumn, but he's the leading expert on AI. He said that the hardest bit of, and the most interesting and complicated bit of artificial intelligence is teaching irrationality and emotion, because that's what defines humans.
But I think what's so worrying is that even though people following, Lil Michaela has 1.3 million followers, even people following her know that all of her emotions and her words are actually being written by like a lab in the Brood technology centre. Mm. It's not Lil Michaela, there's nothing behind her, and yet people don't care, you know? And also the worrying thing as well that's said in this piece is Lil Michaela never has an off day. she doesn't have like friends or family to worry about, like not being able to meet like a deadline or a photo shoot.
Well, exactly. But that it's that fallibility and irrationality
that makes us human.
But that's what they can. That's what's so proving so difficult to replicate. He was
Thank
saying.
God. What worries me though is that we're getting to a point where people don't actually care about that.
Fake influencer is my bio now. Support for the Hilo comes from the Google Pixel 2. Google has been built on asking questions and challenging the status quo. From search to email to maps and beyond, it has a history of challenging the norm and finding a better way.
Each week, Dolly and I cast our eye over the news and look for someone or something who has challenged the status quo. And this week's winner is Brazilian reporter Julia Guimarães, who was covering the World Cup and has been widely praised after rebuking a football fan who attempted to kiss her while she was preparing to go on live television. Footage of the incident, released by Brazilian channel Sport TV, has been circulating on the internet, showing Guimarães dodging the man's approach and berating him for his unacceptable groping.
Kudos to Julia, and thank you to our sponsor Google and the Google Pixel 2 for allowing us to indulge our curiosity always. It's now time for the top line, read by Pandora.
You've got me on the go, running to and fro, looking high and low.
John Lewis is currently trialling a scheme whereby they will buy back clothes that are unworn or unwanted by customers in an attempt to reduce the 300,000 tonnes of clothes that Britain sends to a landfill every year. In collaboration with social enterprise Stuffster, a courier collects unwanted clothes, and for every £50 worth that has been collected in order to be resold or upcycled, you will receive a gift card. It has been revealed that a sexual assault case in Rome was dropped against the head of Italy's national football team, Carlo Tavecchio, because the victim was too old to be distressed by it. The report, filed in Rome and obtained by The Guardian, said that at 50 years old, Elisabetta Cortani would not have been scared. Tavecchio resigned last year after suggesting that football stadiums could be used as lap dancing venues. India is suffering from the worst drought in history, with 600 million people of India's 1.2 billion population suffering serious water shortages. 200,000 people die every year in India due to a lack of access to fresh water, and it is thought that by 2030, almost 40% of the population will have no access to clean water at all. The NHS is to open its first ever clinic for internet and gaming addicts. The Centre for Internet Disorders, a unit opening in central London, will hold weekly group therapy sessions. A couple had been given a life sentence for killing their au pair in London over a bizarre obsession with an ex-Boyzone pop star. Sabrina Quida and Wisi Maduni starved and tortured the nanny in the weeks leading up to her death in September last year. She was beaten and tortured by her employers after being accused of being in league with Quida's ex-partner Mark Walton, a founding member of the Irish boy band Boyzone. The couple interrogated their nanny for hours to extract some sort of confession to confirm their perverted suspicions by dunking her head in a bath. A huge moorland fire has forced people to spend the night away from their homes as the Greater Manchester blaze continues to spread. The fire on Saddleworth Moor, which measures 3.7 miles, has been raging since Sunday night. The police have declared that Saddleworth Moor is a major incident and said that the army is on standby to step in. A slice of Fatberg put on show at the Museum of London could be preserved for future generations. The lump of congealed fat, oil and wet wipes has begun to sweat and change colour, and flies have hatched in it. But curator Vicky Sparks says the Fatberg has caused a marked increase in visitors to the museum, that they are now thinking of preserving it when it finishes its public display this week. It has become something of a sewage celebrity. The death sentence handed to a Sudanese teenager who killed her husband after he raped her has now been overturned. Noura Hussein is no longer on death row after her country's appeal court released its verdict, reducing her conviction from premeditated murder to unlawful killing. Naheed Jabrala from the human rights group SEMA Centre helped organise Noura Hussein's defence, and she has called the appeal court verdict, after a hugely engaged with change.org petition, which we flagged up in an earlier episode of The Hilo, a step for justice in Sudan. Women at Zhenjiang College in China are getting lessons in how to sit, dress, and properly apply makeup. This new class in feminine virtue is a response to a broader push under Xi Jinping's presidency toward traditional gender roles. There is no equivalent course for men. The new class was launched in March, shortly after China did away with presidential term limits, which means Jinping could rule indefinitely. Jinping has presented himself as a supporter of women's equality, once calling it a great cause, but his policies suggest otherwise. Tennis champions are divided over Serena Williams after it was revealed that the 7-time world champion may not be seeded for Wimbledon thanks to her maternity leave. Williams, who is currently rated 183 in the world thanks to all the matches she has missed, should not be penalised for starting a family, said Katrina Adams, the president of the United States Tennis Federation. British number one Joe Konter complained that the 32nd seed would be booted out for Serena, whilst Caroline Wozniacki and John McEnroe are in favour of her being in the top 32. McEnroe, who said he'd place her 10th or 16th at worst, said of the 32nd seed who would be booted out, "What's her name? No offence, you're talking about Serena." Serena herself has been quiet on the subject, but she has said that if she wasn't playing tennis, she'd be having another child right now, and that she doesn't know if she will continue to play when she has another child. And that was the top line.
You've got me on the go, running to and fro, looking high and low.
A nice bit of behind-the-scenes gossip for you there. Pandora had to read out the Slice of Fatberg story 4 times, and then I had to go in a different room because I was making her laugh too much.
So disgusting. A sewage celebrity.
Yeah, yeah. I like that it's beginning to sweat. That's my favourite bit about
Google image it. It's actually, strangely, not as offensive as it sounds.
No, it just looks like a fossil, actually.
Which is very unusual in life. Normally things are visually more offensive. This defies expectation.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Our author special this week is with the actor and now memoirist, Gabourey Sidibe. Gabourey first rose to fame with her incredibly powerful and award-winning role as Precious in the eponymously titled 2009 film based on the novel Push by Sapphire. She has since starred in films such as Tower Heist and White Bird in a Blizzard and the TV series The Big C, American Horror Story, and as Becky in the musical series Empire. She recently made her directorial debut with the short film The Tale of Four. Now she's written a book. This Is Just My Face, Try Not to Stare, tells the story of her unusual childhood, her subway singing star of a mother, her relationship to sexuality, body image, mental health, and the story of how she rose to fame as an actor in Hollywood and how others reacted to that. All told in a fast-paced, totally unique, witty, and ruthlessly honest voice.
Gabourey, welcome to London, to Northwest London, to our studio.
Thank you for having me.
I liked on Twitter when you said that you just popped over to London to buy some Nurofen Plus from Boots.
Do y'all know how special that is?
I do, because I buy it all the time.
It's fantastic.
It is wonderful.
Boots is incredible. I went there yesterday, and I can't promise I won't be back today.
That's so funny, because I feel that about Dwayne Reed.
See, do you?
Yeah.
Thank you, because I know that Boots is like Dwayne Reed here. It feels super unfancy, but I'm sorry. You cannot get Nurofen Plus anywhere else. It's amazing.
And also, you can get a nice little prawn sandwich from Boots. Which,
can you?
Yeah, the meal deal's great. Yeah.
What?
It's fiscally prudent and nutritionally valuable.
Yeah. Come on, fiscally prudent?
It's very important. The book is a hilarious read. I think my favourite line might be the very last line in your acknowledgements, which reads, "Lastly, a shout out to my therapist. Get that money, girl."
Yeah, get it.
I gobbled the book in one sitting, so thank you for breathing it into life. What made you want to write This Is Just My Face?
So I wrote a speech for Gloria Steinem was having like a birthday party slash award ceremony for herself. And so I wrote a speech about confidence and how often I'm asked about my confidence and how I'm only asked about my confidence because people think I shouldn't have it. Mm. Like, it's one of those. Mm. And so, it's not, how are you so confident? It's, how are you so confident? Like, that's what it is. I had to, like, you know, talk about, like, where my confidence comes from and, you know, really where it doesn't come from. Because I wrote about how, like, when I was in elementary school, I actually had no friends. And no one liked me. Because, like, not for any, like, sad reason, but because I was just really smart and kind of a dick. Does that make sense? I think it's really
that
hard.
That was such a leveler, because you're like, I'm really smart, and it's like, oh, ego much? And then it was like, exactly. But I'm a bit of a dick, and it's like, putting yourself right there back it is. In place.
See, because I'm smart and honest. And no one likes anyone very smart honest. Ever. And very so I had honest. No friends, and sort of in the speech sort of went viral, and then I got a lot of incoming calls, you know, from people who thought I had a book in me, and I really wrote it to see if I did.
Turns out you did.
Yeah, turns out I did. Well, I am smart again.
So. Let's start at the very beginning. You had a very unconventional childhood with your Senegalese father marrying your mother for a green card before moving his second wife, who he secretly married in a solo trip back to Senegal, into your family home, pretending that she was his cousin.
Oh, no, she was his cousin.
Oh. Like she was actually his cousin.
Yeah, actually his cousin.
Oh, I thought she just pretended she was his cousin. No. To marry her. She's both of those things. She's his cousin and his wife.
He pretended she was just his cousin.
But that was cool. Understood.
Yeah. It was a love affair.
So this was obviously incredibly disorientating for you, especially because your father was not a particularly good father to you growing up, but the way you write about your family is incredibly honest and funny, even when there are these very painful moments. You write, "My father courted my mother for a whole year after they got married before she finally fell for him enough to sleep with him. That's right, my mum is so classy that you have to marry her and then wait a year before she gives you any play." Was writing this memoir a cathartic experience? Because it is a real journey through your relationship, particularly with your father, I think.
Yeah, well, when I first started writing the book, I was done with him. Mm-hmm. Like, just sort of, like, as an idea. I was like, no thanks, I'm good. I wasn't talking to him. But, you know, I often think about people who have, like, ghostwriters, and I wonder if you get, like, the full experience of writing a book if you have a ghostwriter, because then it's you telling your life to someone else and then them telling it back to you. But if you're not the one in charge of the story, then you don't get to learn about yourself in the same way. You know what I mean? And so I learned so much about myself, and also I got to learn about my family. And, you know, one thing that happens that they don't tell you happens, like, when you're growing up, is that someday you'll have to look at your parents as people and not just as parents. And not just as people who either, you know, are God, you know, so you exalt them in every choice they've ever made. Totally. Is the most fantastic thing, or the worst, just because it's not your choice. Because I think we have a tendency to either demonize or glorify our parents instead of seeing them as people.
Yeah.
Who are fallible, absolutely, and who are human, and who have lots of different, you know, qualities, and also that have a life outside of you. Mm. And I had to write about my parents' marriage in order to forgive my father for having that second wife and having this whole other family. Because, you know, when it was happening, and for many years, even into my adulthood, I was like, how could he betray us like this? And how could he have this second wife and this second family? And how dare he do this to us? But I was looking at it as a child and also as an American. But he married her in Senegal, which is very different than the way you can marry someone in America. America, we, like, you know, get courts, or I guess here you guys involve courts, but it's just as easy to be, I mean, like, we could do it right now. Like, all I have to do is get our parents to agree that we're married. You say, I marry you, I marry you, I marry you, 3 times.
Wow.
And then to divorce someone, it's just as easy. Your parents decide, your whole family decides your divorce. I divorce you, I divorce you, I divorce you. It's just that easy.
Oh my God.
Yeah, so he really did not break any laws. But I have to say, you know, from my American sensibilities, my dad was a polygamist and a cheater and a betrayer. But in Senegal, my dad was just a man. He was an average man. I had to write about that to see that he's not some evil person.
And actually, it's interesting that you said that, because as you were saying about how getting older is about viewing your parents as people, something that I've had to really grapple with is understanding, okay, who am I because of my upbringing, my parents and my context and my culture? And then who are they with their context and their upbringing and their culture.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's something we, if we're lucky, we come to this realization that they're not screwing with us on purpose, that they did not hurt us on purpose, and that also that they're not just, you know, the best people with the best opinions in the planet, because that can also be, you know,
damaging.
Yeah, absolutely. It can be damaging. And I don't think we get to see our parents as people. We just don't. And now I get to see him as a person.
Yeah, I mean, your father, you just consistently referred to him as a boring cab driver.
I mean, and that's not to say he's not.
But he's other things as well.
He's multifaceted to someone, I suppose. It was funny. So in the States, my book came out last year in May. And my birthday is in May. And so my book agent threw me a book party. By no stretch of the imagination was it a birthday party. I invited my dad, and I was like, oh, you should come. And my dad came with 5 children who I'd never met.
Oh my God.
If they were in this room right now, I would not be able to recognize them. Wow. But they would technically be my brothers and sisters. I can't even tell you how many they were or what their names are or any of that. And my dad sat at the party the whole time on the couch, as if there were French news in front of him. He was exactly the boring cab driver that I described him to be. I was like, look, you guys, he's doing the thing. He's doing it. And everyone's like, yeah, he is boring.
Because in the book you say he just sits watching French news all the live long day.
I do.
They're invested.
And he is. No, yeah, he really needs to know what's going on there. He is worried, okay?
Something you excel at is talking about incredibly serious and at times very troubling things that you've experienced in life with the most amazing ease, which is not to say that I imagine it was easy to write, but to read it is an easy experience. Was it important to you that when you wrote about the more challenging moments of your life, that you did so with a straightforwardness or even at times with a dark humour? In particular, I'm thinking about the segment in which you talk about you, your mother and your brother living in one room for 5 years. And you said we lived closer than ever, but we grew further apart. Familiarity breeds contempt and we couldn't stand one another.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's pretty truthful. It was really, really important to be as honest as possible for me, because otherwise it just didn't make any sense to be writing. Like, I could have been doing anything else. But I've trouble faking things. I mean, outside of, I guess, being an actress, I have trouble lying. And I just think there's some danger there in lying and pretending. And I didn't want to do it in my book at all. And also, a lot of the things I was saying in the book, I'd never said out loud, you know, ever. And it's not that I didn't have those thoughts before. I just wasn't sharing them because we all knew we were in the same room. we all shared a bunk bed. And my friends, it wasn't like a thing that I complained about to my friends, because I didn't talk about it with my friends, because I was in junior high and the last thing I wanted to be was different. The last thing I wanted to be perceived as was poor. Not that no one in my junior high was poor. We all were. But we didn't talk about it. No one did. And so that chapter was really, really hard to write because it was the first time I was ever talking about it. And I'm really glad that I did. Because when you're going through things, especially when you're a teenager, and I do, a lot of my humor is straight up out of a defense mechanism. Straight up. And in joking about things, you don't really get to deal with them. It's immediate. The second I get cut, there's the Band-Aid immediately. There's the alcohol. I'm just going to take care of it immediately. But in that, sometimes the wound doesn't get a chance to actually heal. And so writing about that experience was the actual act of me healing that wound.
Support for The High-Low comes from Moët and Chandon, and today Pandora is thrilled that we're going to be talking about something incredibly close to her heart, rosé.
Rosé is my favourite, whatever the weather. Given the opportunity, I'd mull rosé and drink it at Christmas. I'm sure, given the heatwave, many of our listeners are cracking open the rosé on deck chairs, in the park, and if they're lucky enough, in their garden. But did you know that rosé, while deliciously chuggable solo, is actually the perfect accompaniment to food?
Rosé champagne is actually far more versatile as a food wine than any other wine. It has an intensity and fruitiness, yet it still retains a sensational freshness. paired with beef and meat due to the Pinot Noir, providing deeper, more concentrated notes, making it perfect for a barbecue tipple. Moët's Rosé Imperial is best paired with uncomplicated Italian food, flavoured with olive oil and tomatoes, to enhance both the elegant simplicity of the champagne and the quality of the ingredients.
Italian food and rosé champagne sounds like our perfect evening, doll.
Let's go do it now. Thanks very much to Moët and Shandon.
You were cast in Precious at the age of 24?
Yeah.
By which time you were working in a phone sex call centre to earn money to fund your third attempt at college, and you write hilariously about the phone sexery, as you call it. When you're auditioning for Lee Daniels, who directed you in Precious, he calls you smart, and you say, oh great, another person who thinks I'm smart. Can I stop listening to guys beg me to make them wear panties over the phone now? And then another time, which I loved, you describe how women would wet the palms of their hands and slap them against something to simulate the sound of a wet vagina. So talk to us about the phone sexery. Does that all seem quite surreal now?
Yeah, I was a phone hoe. You know what's funny? The thing, like, I swear to God, like, most things, again, things sort of just, like, get out of hand for me. That company had been up for about 15 years before I joined. And the second I got Precious, I maybe went back and did one shift. We auditioned on Tuesday, hired Wednesday. We started shooting 3 weeks later. So I had 3 weeks. And so I went back for one shift. And then, like, mid-shift, I was like, I'm too fancy. Done. And, like I it already had gone to my head. And so I stopped doing it. But by the time we were still shooting, we were literally on our last week of shooting. And I got a call from my boss who told me that this like 20-something-year-old company was now out of order, completely belly up, because they really, really needed my phone sucking skills, you guys. They really needed me there. But without me, they suffered. And really, the company closed down before I was done filming Precious.
You talk very honestly about your relationship to sex, and in particular, you talk about how you were disconnected from it for a while after you lost your virginity. You say, I kept trying to make sex feel good, but it didn't, not with anyone. And I really tried. I tried to make a game out of it. I'd try on a character and see if she'd have more fun, but she did not. And I think that's a shared experience for a lot of young women. You go on to say that you recognised your pseudo-promiscuity was part of your depression and not a distraction from it. Can you tell me a bit more about that and how that has changed as you've grown up?
It's a great term, pseudo-promiscuity, because I think a lot of girls fool themselves into thinking that they, you know, are actually a good time gal and that they want to sleep with all these men, but that's not actually how they feel. If you want to do that, great, go for it. It's 2018, but often they're not feeling like that inside. And I definitely know people who would go, God, but yeah, I definitely had a pseudo-promiscuous time.
Yeah, I think we all, I think, not that, you know, HBO is to blame, but I think that we see characters like, you know, Carrie from Sex and the City, and we think, oh, I can do that, or I can be that, or that's really fun, or like, this is what my life should be. I'm young and I'm not married. And that's not to say it shouldn't be that, but I think that I was really pushing it.
Yeah.
I was pushing something that I really wasn't, and something that I really wasn't ready for it, you know. I just felt, chronologically, I felt ready for it because I was 20, you know, and I felt like, this is the age, and I'm the last virgin I know, the last virgin on earth, and I can't be this anymore, and I had to, it was more of a mission. And I sometimes find that, so, like, it was very much a mission, but I guess I really had to get it done. And what's changed now is, one, I do the things I want to do. And not that I was forced into any sexual situations then, but I forced myself, you know.
You put pressure on yourself because that's what you thought, as you said, chronologically.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I thought, well, that's normal, and you don't feel normal, and you don't think normally, and you don't act normally. And so you got to go get you some normal. So do that, because that's what everyone's doing. So go ahead, be normal. And it wasn't normal for me, and I had to learn that. And I do still very much, I do fixate on certain missions every now and then, like, as an adult, like, if I'm like, oh, I gotta bone that guy, like, I usually do, but usually, I mean, like, this one time, but also, I realize I do still fixate on missions, and sometimes I fixate on men, and I try to conquer them, And usually when I do, I'm just like, what are you doing, stupid? Chill out. Like, nothing. But I no longer pressure myself into doing things I don't want to do. Like, usually when I fixate on a man, I do want him.
You are an anomaly in Hollywood because you are not thin. You have recounted how the actor Joan Cusack told you to quit acting because it was too image conscious for you to succeed. How interviewers would ask you if you plan to lose weight, and the difference in how you and Quentin Aaron, a large black man, were received. You were called a fat bitch and he was called a big teddy bear. It's all pretty shocking to read, even though we know how sizist Hollywood is and how misogynistic it is, because obviously it's to do with the size of women and relative to the size of men. How did you build up resilience to this, and how do you think it has shaped, no pun intended, your career?
It was really, honestly, I have no other option. Like, I've, like, you know, people are like, oh, what's it like to be a black actress? I'm like, I don't know, because that's all I am. Like, I don't know what it's like to be a white actress. Like, what's it like to be a plus size actress? That's literally all I've ever offered. Like, it's everything that I am. And I work, like, no matter what people say. I remember when I was like nominated for the Oscar and for all these different awards, there was talk about how I'll never work again because of my body. And people were saying, like, people were very sure.
Howard Stern said it was, like, unfair for you to be given that role because you wouldn't get another or something. Do you chuckle to yourself and think, fuck you?
I literally had two jobs when he lined up, when he said it. And not that it didn't, like, affect me. It really, the thing is, like, a lot of, like I say, I'm not great at pretending, but that's, like, a huge part of my job. Not just as an actor, but, like, I'm supposed to pretend that, like, what people say, you know, in front of a wide audience doesn't hurt my feelings, when, like, actually it does. Not because I'm weak, but, like, I just happen to be human. And so if you, like, tell your audience of millions of people that I'm, like, too fat to ever work again, that hurts my feelings just because I'm a normal person.
Of course. And actually, something I love in the book is when you say you talk about your feelings being hurt. And of course, that would be very hurtful as well as very embarrassing. And you said feelings aren't an absence of strength. I know this for sure.
No, they're not. And if you think of, like, if you, okay, you know how, like, when you're in high school and you walk up to a table and everyone stops talking and you know that they were talking about you? And then, so imagine that, but it's not just the table of your friends. It's your entire grade. But then it's your entire school. And then it's your entire region. And it just, like, gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And then, like, there's a huge spotlight on you. And you don't, you know, it's just, and it's really, really scary. And it's a lot to deal with. But every actor, honestly, you don't even have to be an actor anymore. It's social media. I don't really think of it as resiliency. I just know that every day I have to get up. Every day I have to go to work. These bills got to pay themselves. I still have a call sheet to adhere to. I still have work. I still have. And not only do I have other people's art to show up for, like in the case of, like, Empire, that's not my show, but I'm on it. But I have my own art that I'm making, like my film. And I'm probably going to write more books. I have things to do, and I don't need opinions to do them or to not do them. Now I say this thing where I'm like, look, you're not going to fight me and you're not going to evict me. Nothing that anyone has ever said has affected my life in real life and in real time. Maybe my feelings, but I still went to work.
The internet features quite heavily in your book, which I loved because obviously it's a big part of your day-to-day life, as it is for many of us. And it seems like it's also a part of kind of your identity as well. You describe your love-hate relationship with Twitter and also feature a list of things you'd love to tweet but you can't, which I loved. One of them is...
Uh-oh.
No, because I would love to tweet this.
Okay, good.
My New Year's resolution is to start asking Uber drivers to not talk to me without sounding like a bitch. Fuck it. It's impossible.
It's impossible! It's impossible! Try it!
I know that babies stare at me because they're curious or whatever, but I still kind of want to fight them.
I do
want to
fight a baby, yes.
Hashtag
cancel me. Cancel. I saw that, but that baby's cute though. Whose baby is that?
Your my baby? One.
That baby's good baby. She's cute.
Hashtag rude ass baby. Zadie's not a rude ass baby.
First of all, your babies be rude. And, like, your baby seems fine, but babies be rude. That's not on me.
So what's your relationship like to social media now? Because you describe it in the book as, like, which I definitely identify with, as a cycle of love and hate.
It's so fun.
Yeah.
Also, I hate it. It's evil. It's so a bad place. That's where we go to cancel people. It's terrible. It's really, really, really fun. And it's so funny. And you can almost say whatever you want. Not me. I can't say whatever I want.
I was going to say, some people do say whatever
some people
want.
Do, and I applaud those people.
One of the strangest experiences you've had online is having to read a much-circulated hoax about your own death. I mean, I have to say, I read it with my heart in my mouth. I would have found it really trippy and stressful and ghoulish and anxiety-inducing. What was that experience like?
Oh my God, it was the worst. It was the worst, because at first it was like kind of funny, because I was like, haha, no, I'm not stupid. I'm right here.
I think I would not have found it funny, I have to say.
For a millisecond did I think it was funny. I for a millisecond. And then all of a sudden it was, I went from being like, haha, I'm right here, to am I here? You know, because like there's a moment where you're like, am I dead? Is the internet right? It's not.
Quite Zoolander, that.
Exactly.
Who am I?
But then it's, and then it was like really, really annoying and offensive, because it said that I had died while running in a scene in a movie. Like, my fat ass heart could never, like, you could never run. She should have known better than to run. My dad, who I was barely talking to at the time, called me to make sure I was alive, because my brother had told him I was dead. And it's just like, it's like, what a horrible way for anyone to find out that someone that they love is dead, you know, or has passed. And then I remember like talking about it with my mom, and then my mom forgot. And like, my mom and I were like, haha, this is so fun. Because I mean, for her sake, I sort of made it a joke.
Yeah, of course.
So that
yeah.
she wouldn't, and I like found a way to make it funny. And then it wasn't, because she called me, because her sister had called her to like find out what was going on. And then she didn't know, so she called my phone. And like she left this message, and the message wasn't to me. It was to whoever might have my phone, because I'm dead now. And it's just like, you can't do that to people in their lives. Like, this is the problem with the internet. This is the problem with it. You can just say anything, and enough people are... See, like, the internet's really smart, but human beings real dumb.
Another area that I was blown away by was your honesty, and I was actually completely gripped as well, because it's so rarely discussed by Hollywood stars, is when you talk about what happened to your family when you became famous. You say you became a walking ATM, and that your family called you less, but when they did, it was always for money, and that your father became, in your own words, truly relentless. Can you talk a little bit about how fame not only felt to you, but how it changed your family?
Yeah, I was determined to finish that chapter, but I swear it might have taken me a month to write it. I was determined to finish it, but it was really, really hard to get through. Yeah. Because I don't think anyone does talk about fame and money and what it does. And sometimes it felt like a bomb that went off in my family. Mm-hmm. You know, this thing that had affected all of us. In such a negative way, because also, like, what happens is there's a lot of resentment, but there's also, like, a bigger need.
Well, there's this bit that's quite funny when your mother says to you, but Gabourey, we know how much you've worth. We've looked at Wikipedia, you're worth $2 million, and you're like, you're not factoring in the tax.
Yeah. Also, like, I don't know where that $2 million, I mean, I was very much, like, renting. At the time, my apartment was, like, $1,700 a month. And I, every month, I was like, I don't know how I'm going to do it. Like, every month, I didn't know how I was going to pay.
Well, you're going to pay it with your $2 million.
Which, like, goddamn Google and Wikipedia and all those, but they lie, and they don't factor in the tax at all. And they also, like, I think that, you know, my family doesn't, I'm from a poor family. None of us know how to have money. Certainly, we don't know how to keep money, you know, because we never had it to keep. I had to learn how to have money, but I couldn't learn it from my parents. And because they're so much older than me, I also cannot teach it to them. And not just because they're older, because, like, I'm their daughter. They're not going to learn anything from me. Like,
it's a very particular education as well, going from being poor to very comfortable. But as you say, in this kind of quite extraordinary position, I mean, you know,
being in an Oscar-nominated film. That's not the normal way that people suddenly become successful.
And on top of that, I was the poorest person in the film. Like, everybody else, like, had money already. It was my first ever job. And then after that, like, it's not like I'm, like, all of a sudden making $1 million a picture. Like, that really isn't what it is. Like, I'm very much a working actress. Very much a working actress. And also, like, I work by myself. Everything I do on my... Like, even writing the book, I, like, wrote something about how, like, I'm up at 4 a.m. because I have to be at work at 6, but I've been writing all night and I'm just going to write till 5:30 and then in the shower. And I do everything I do on my own, but yet I'm constantly having, I have to pay this person's rent and I have to pay this person's rent. And then I have my rent and then a mortgage and all these things. It's constantly shelling out money, like hair, makeup, all these things cost money. And you just have to keep making it. And my parents don't understand, like, even if I did have $2 million, it's spent. And I didn't have it, I swear.
Gabourey, in your own words, I'd survived an almost 3-year eating disorder, panic attacks, depression, and falling out of school. You've not only done that, you've established yourself as an actor, director, and now author. Could you read us an excerpt from your book?
Oh yeah, what do you want me to read?
What do you want to read?
Ooh, I know. So, like, I still go on these, like, ridiculous, is this a date? I actually asked once, and it was not a date. I just, like, went out with this guy, and then I was like, you know what? I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm not going to wonder if this is a date. I'm not going to, like, add up these points and subtract them. I'm not going to do them. I'm just going to go ahead and ask. Like, this guy's clearly into me. And so I go, I have a question. Is this a date? And he goes, I swear it was, like, a 7-minute Like, he truly did. He was like, I don't know. Did you want it to be a date? Because I was just thinking of it as us hanging out. And then I never saw that guy again. But I swear
I don't think
God.
Men want
to
hang out, I have to say.
This is what I'm saying. Yeah. Why are you being nice to me?
Yeah. Why do you want to hang out with a girl you've just met when you've got loads of friends?
Yeah, like, I agree.
If it's not a date. Fuck you. I'm from the When Harry Met Sally school of thought on that.
Yeah. Men and women can't be friends. I honestly, like, the very least, I'm not looking for no friends.
Are we like, friends, CJ? We all friends.
Is this a date, CJ? What's up?
We're colleagues.
Okay, so I think this is like when we're doing like points and stuff. Okay, so like every dumb date or non-date or link up, whatever code these terrible men come up with is happening when I'm on them, because it takes me a while to get to them anyway, because like I'm busy. But also I just genuinely never really believe when a guy's like interested in me, because it's almost never a date. So then flirty dude is all like, meet me at this place for dinner. Dinner. Does he mean dinner or does he mean dinner? You know what I mean? Also, he said meet up. If this was a date, he would have picked me up, right? Like, that just makes sense to me. This is where the real non-fun begins, because you have to start adding and subtracting points. Meet me will cost this date 5 points. If he says, what's your address? I'll pick you up. You can give the date 10 points until you remember that your gay best friend and your straight platonic male friend also pick you up, which happens. My gay friends and my platonic male friend. I should get rid of my platonic male friend, right? Who needs him? You get it, CJ. So you dive deep into your own psyche and you deduct 10 points for being crazy before you even get in the car. Now, once you've officially at the link up, once you've lunk, you can start to assess the situation at hand. Did he bring you anything? Flowers or something? A Snickers bar? What do I think a Snickers bar is equal to a bouquet of flowers? I do, though. A Snickers bar or a keychain from some other city he was just visiting? I ask because this has happened to me. A guy who truly did not want to bone me planned a link up with me and brought me flowers and a cross from Canada. Oh, I remember that dude. And it was confusing as fuck. I mean, you want to think gifts. This is definitely a date. 100 points. But I assure you, flirty dude is definitely up to something sinister. Flowers? The fuck? Deduct 500 points. And that's what this book is about.
Oh my God. Gabourey, I could listen to you read that all day. Thank you so much for coming on. This is Just My Face is out now, published by Penguin Random House.
Thank you very much to Gabourey, and thank you to everyone who listened. You can email The High Low, thehighlowshow@gmail.com, or you can tweet us at The High Low Show. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.